Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
It looks like the Army is on track to meet its recruitment goals for the first time in almost a decade. Things are also looking up for the Air Force this year, but the Navy is projected to miss its recruitment targets again. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis has the latest numbers for us. Anastasia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Eric.
So how's the Army doing this year on its recruitment efforts?
Well, the Army wants to bring in 55,000 new soldiers this year. We're 6 months into the fiscal year, and so far, things look pretty promising for the service. Army Secretary Christine Wormuth said that they have a pretty good shot at meeting the goal this year. But to put this into perspective, last year, they wanted to bring in 65,000 people, and they missed that mark by 10,000 new soldiers. Now, it's important to add that this year, the leadership made a decision to shrink the size of its force by about 24,000 troops. And they mainly cut empty posts. And the reasoning behind that was that they want to prepare for large scale operations as they're moving away from supporting counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations for the last two decades. And given all that, the Army is on track to meet its goals of having 470,000 soldiers by fiscal 2029.
And other than curtailing their expectations, the Army has struggled for quite some time with its recruitment. What are some of the other reforms they've introduced that are helping them to finally meet those recruitment goals?
Yeah, so the Army Secretary attributes a lot of success to its Future Soldier Prep course. They launched that in 2022, and it has an academic track and a physical track. And it basically helps recruits meet standard requirements before they go into the basic training. The program so far has been pretty successful. They have graduated about 18,000 people, and the success rate is about 95%. So a lot of people take on leadership roles during basic training, and right now they're conducting a study where they're following those people. And once they get their first assignments, they see how they perform. Another thing that they're doing is they're transforming the way that their recruitment offices are run. Basically, A, they want to have a career track for recruiters, but they're also transforming everything about recruitment. Like, they're utilizing a lot of technology. For example, right now, they're standing up an innovation directorate, and that will be a part of the Army Recruiting Command. The new unit will help develop a pipeline of those specialized recruiters. This new unit will also help integrate artificial intelligence and machine learning technologies into recruitment. So those are just a couple of examples of what they're doing to meet their recruitment goals.
We're speaking with Federal News Network defense reporter Anastasia Obis. And so what about the Air Force? The things seem to be on the up and up for their recruitment goals.
Yes, indeed. Last year, the Air Force missed their recruitment goal for the first time since 1999. They are cautiously optimistic, that's what they say, about their recruitment goals. They want to bring in 26,000 active duty airmen this year. Things look good so far, and they actually upped that number by 1,200, but that's also in response to a decline in retention rates this year. They've also introduced a lot of new reforms last year and this year. They relaxed their tattoo policy. They now allow lawful permanent residents to enlist. And they also started offering different incentives for new recruits. So it looks like those changes are bringing some positive results. Let's take a listen to Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall on what he thinks about their recruitment efforts.
We're actually doing very well this year. The active force is on track at this point to essentially meet its goals. In fact, we're looking at revising the goals up slightly. The reserves are doing well also. The Guard has improved their performance over last year, but is not quite meeting their target. So we took a number of steps. General Alvin led a group, a task force, that changed some of our policies to expand the envelope of the people that we would bring in. We did not lower our standards, but we made some adjustments. That helped a lot.
And that's Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall. So what about the Navy, though? Is that the only service falling behind? What's going on there?
Yes, so far they are the only ones, and this is the second time they're missing their goals. Last year they were about 7,000 new sailors short. This year they are short by about 67,000 new sailors. They've also introduced a lot of different things. Actually, earlier this year, I think about a couple of months ago, they made a decision to allow recruits without a high school diploma or a GED to enlist. And basically, as long as new recruits score over 50 on their qualification test, they're good to go. But again, they just introduced that, so we will know if that's bringing in positive results. Vice Admiral Rick Cheeseman said, and I quote, "We continue to face challenges in the current economic environment and tough labor market." And, you know, the mixed bag that we're getting here, that we're getting this year, it reflects the challenging environment that all of the services are having. It highlights all of the challenges that the military faces when it comes to their recruitment efforts. You know, things like a strong labor market, general lack of awareness about military service among young people, restricted access to high schools in the post-pandemic world, and growing distrust in public institutions, just among a lot of other factors. All of those are contributing to this difficult environment. Air Force Alex Wagner said that all of those things have just turned into a perfect storm for the last 2 years, or for the last several years, making it really difficult to recruit.
All right. Well, we'll see if these efforts come to any sort of fruition. Federal News Network's defense reporter, Anastasia Obis, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Eric.
And you can find more of Anastasia's reporting at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.